folks.
I want to go on to Wesley's topic as well, but this picture of the eclipse of Phobos, taken from Curiosity. They show one picture. They took actually hundreds of pictures as this thing crossed the face of the sun, and eventually they'll upload it through the orbital satellites, and then they're going to make a video out of it. But right now it's just one picture that you could look at, and it's just a piece of it of the sun that's missing. It's really cool. And this type of thing is what I think is very interesting. You mentioned the astronomy. I thought I'd bring that up. It's amazing that the cameras don't burn out, but this thing was designed for that. It's got all the filters, and they point the camera right into the sun. It came from the mass cam. Back to you, Dick.
Those so-called cameras on Curiosity are really something else. One of those cameras will take that laser output beam, which runs a million watts approximately of peak envelope power for very brief periods of time, focuses it down to a dot that's I don't know the exact number, but it's in the vicinity of an eighth of an inch in diameter, something like 20 feet away. You can focus that beam with this Cassegrain-like telescope system. You focus that beam, you make it into a fine dot on that rock that's 20 feet away. You burn a hole in that rock, and as the rock vaporizes and gives off various wavelengths of light during each one of those pulses, you measure the spectrum of those pulses, and you look at those signatures of that spectrum, and you say, aha, I recognize that kind of rock and that kind of metal, and so on. You're doing a spectrum analysis. You're doing you're finding out what kind of materials are present in that rock, even though you're not touching it, and even though it's up to 20 feet away. Fantastic. Paul, if you had to make a guess, what's your guess as to the total number of cameras that are on the Curiosity Mars Science Laboratory? WS2N, K2LIW.
Yeah, they call it a mass spectrometer that takes some pictures of that. Yeah, that's actually in the body of the Curiosity, and that's actually doing the work, taking a picture after it gets zapped with a million degrees. The equivalent of a million degrees or something that's hitting the little rock. Amazing. There's 17 cameras on board. 17 cameras. They're all over the place.
That's all? I'm joking. Only 17 cameras. They're down to their last 17 cameras. Each has a special purpose, as you can tell. What a machine that is. As I was starting to say now, one of the things that, one of the real gems that Wesley gave us, and hopefully it's already been transferred to Bernie's website so you can also look it up, is this website that talks about particle versus wave. But it really goes way beyond that. The particular website is a YouTube video, and some of the YouTube videos we've seen in the past are not so exciting. This particular YouTube video is done by MIT Professor Walter Lewy, L-E-W-I. So Walter Lewy and his so-called Physics 801 Lecture Number 34 goes into demonstrations as well as beautiful blackboard discussions.
Dick, how do they generate the laser on that thing?
I am guessing it's a high-power gaseous laser being fed by fiber optics from the body of the Curiosity up to its Cassegrain telescope. What they first do is decide that, hey, that particular rock, let me pick a number, 10 feet away, and the center of that rock looks like it might contain something interesting. So they take this Cassegrain telescope-like thing and focus it on that dot of the rock until you get a clear picture with no blur. Now you know your optical system is properly focused. Then the laser is turned on and produces I think it's something like 5 pulses of 5 nanoseconds each. Each pulse is a megawatt of power. And I am guessing it's a high-power gaseous laser. It's an infrared laser. They did make that clear. In other words, the laser puts out only infrared light. But because the light it puts out is so intense that the materials that it vaporizes become a glowing material. And when you glow material, you are exciting those individual molecules of the material to a much higher state. The individual atoms are being excited to a higher state of its electrons in those orbits. As those orbits of those electrons drop back down to the ground state, they give off very specific amounts of energy at very specific wavelengths. So the emitted light by the glowing gas, the plasma that you create by the laser blast, is what gets analyzed in this mass spectrometer. So what is really making that megawatt of peak pulse power out of that laser? Let's see if Paul might know that one. And I guarantee if you dig deep enough in those websites that NASA and JPL is providing to you, you can find that one out. WS2N, if you happen to know, K2LIW in the TechNet. Go ahead, Paul.
Didn't read they run the fiber optics from the cameras all the way down into the body, so the infrared is being generated somewhere in there and then pumped up to the mass. 40 watts of power being generated, but it's hitting, when it hits, you know, it's so focused that they said it's equivalent to 1,000,000 degrees or something when it hits. The time per second, I read 30 pulses per second, and in between each pulse, the camera works, you know, the camera picks things up, so that, you know, it's actually taking 30 pictures per second. It's unbelievable. So, you know, like, if there's dust on the outside, it will be able to tell you what the dust is made of, the cyan oxide usually, and then that blows away, and then they can tell you what's really inside that little rock with the next series of pictures, all within, like, you know, 1 second, no problem. I think they usually fire for 2 or 3 seconds. So it's like 30 pulses per second.
Yeah, I'm led to believe that the actual power output of the laser during the pulse is around a megawatt. And after the focusing, the actual watts per square centimeter or watts per square millimeter is a huge number. And so it's vaporizing that rock, and by the 30 pictures, you know, as you vaporize deeper and deeper into the rock, you know what the materials are for the first few millimeters of the rock, so to speak. To my knowledge, megawatt-like powers out of solid-state laser I don't think is possible. That's why I'm guessing it's a gaseous laser. But you've asked a darn interesting question, N2MB, Barry. And so you've triggered my curiosity. I don't think there are solid-state lasers that go that high in power, but I'm not really sure. I mean, I can buy lasers that go to the 100 milliwatt level, and those are potentially lethal when it comes to human vision, but and I think there's some that go up to a watt, but a megawatt solid state, I doubt it. I think it's gaseous. In fact, if we calculate the volume of the material that are in the lacing device that can produce that amount of power when all of that charged material, charged by its optical pump, charges it, and it's able to issue all that power in some number of picoseconds or nanoseconds. I think it takes volume to do that. That's the reason I'm guessing it's a gaseous laser. Over to you, Barry, if you have any further comments on this. N2 Moonbound, K2LIW.
Hey, Terry Jenks.
Maybe Eric knows. Go ahead, Eric.
Now, two things. I'm going to ask a question, number one, but as far as I know at this point, the solid-state lasers, they've got them as big as 7.5 watts. I haven't heard or read anything bigger than that in terms of solid-state lasers. But I was just wondering, how big a power supply do they have on that thing? Because, like, a typical argon laser or a carbon dioxide laser, if you're talking about those kinds of power, you're talking about peak pulse power, still requires an awful lot of energy to excite those darn things.
Now, 40 watts, Eric, 40.
Yeah, 40 watts for a significant period of time, charging up the gaseous lacing material, and the amount of energy you're getting back out of it is not greater than what went in, but there's a huge difference in time. You may take a second to charge the laser, but what comes back out in my crazy example is only a nanosecond. That's a billion to one ratio in the time domain. So I could charge a capacitor for 1 second. I could then discharge that capacitor, And because I'm discharging it in a nanosecond, and I charged it for a second, I can get what looks like a billion to one power increase. You see what's going on there, Eric? KE2EJ, K2LAW?
No, I understand that, Dick, but you also have size and weight constraints in this thing, so... you know, you're talking about a pretty big capacity, because it takes a certain amount of energy just to ionize the gas to even begin the process of lasing.
But where the highest power solid-state laser you know of is 5 watts, and I have reason to believe that this thing runs an instantaneous power output for very brief periods of time of a megawatt, I am guessing you need a lot more volume of lasing material to do that. Therefore, I'm guessing it's a great big infrared laser of some kind, and I'm guessing it's a gaseous tube being fed by a well-focused exciting system, if you know what I mean. But I think we should all dig into that one. It's a beauty. And Barry's asked an interesting question. Out of curiosity, Barry, what suddenly gave you, I'm a little bit afraid of what your next experiment is going to be. N2MB, K2LAW?
Yeah, well, after hearing about that, we might be bouncing laser signals off the moon or something. Wonder what that stuff costs, how much it weighs, if you could modulate it.
Yeah, they've really broken some ground here and done some nice breakthrough when it comes to a compact, shippable source where the raw power input is something like 40 watts, even though they've only got to 120 watts, 112 watts or something like that comes out of their nuclear thermoelectric generator. And yeah, they can store it with batteries and capacitors and whatever for brief periods of time for these kind of an experiment. So they've got a very compact source. So megawatt peak pulse power infrared source, using that for ranging to the moon would be a lot of fun experiment. And yes, guaranteed there's ways of modulating it and so on. But what I was starting to say now is that that last email of Wes's, where he directs us to a YouTube video, MIT Professor Walter Louis, and I think that particular lecture goes on for 49 minutes, if I understand correctly here. Yeah, 49 minutes, but that is a very worthwhile 49 minutes. Damn smart guy, extremely good lecturer, beautiful examples of the light coming out of things and being polarized and whatever. Nice diagrams on the board. I get the impression that if that lecture number 34 of the series that you can see free of charge from MIT, from a renowned professor, there's probably at least 33 other lectures that are probably almost as good. So I'm starting to hear stories about people who can get the equivalent of a bachelor or a master's degree almost free of charge by simply going online at places like, California Institute of Technology, Caltech, Stanford Research, Stanford University, MIT, probably RPI, RIT, various well-respected schools have series of lectures that you can download, view, and whatever. And so, or listening to the lectures by Feynman, among other people, or Teller. There's some beautiful lectures you can listen to that really give you a lot of information. Is light a particle? Is light a wave? And the answer is yes. Depending on what experiment you're doing, how you sense it, how you set it up, it has the properties of both. And so one of the questions that Wes keeps asking us is there real mass, is there real energy in a radio beam, in a light beam? I'm positive the answer is yes. I can, when it comes to sunlight, that really is a electromagnetic wave coming out of that 5,000 degree surface temperature sun, and that wave is being boiled off, comes through the speed of light, 8 minutes worth of vacuum of space, comes down to my square meter of measuring material, and I'm going to get 1,300 watts per square meter of optical power out of that sun. Does it have energy? Yea, verily. You send that through your telescope as a foolish experiment, aim the telescope at the sun and have your eyepiece there. Oh boy, you don't have an eye anymore. So that's real energy. Does it have mass? Does it have energy? Does it have power? Does it have force? It's got all of the above. Now, optical force is an extremely small number. Mass is an extremely small number, but I believe it's above zero. N2XJN, K2RIW. Back to you, Wes, K2RIW.
Yeah, thank you very much. One of the things, particles like the electron must be transported by the by a wave into which is incorporated. That's the meta and wave particle duality statement. If you can relate to that. Also, another thing, if you take one lambda of gamma ray, it will have 1.24 mega electron volts. If you take one lambda of ELF, very low frequency, you have 12.4 femto electron volts. As we know from the lecture of that professor, Professor Walter Louis, the electron jumps from the higher orbit towards the nuclei. The electron has a different charge than the nuclei by itself, or the proton by itself, and jumps. And now here's the interesting point. The higher the orbit, the shorter the wavelength. I would like you to tell a few words about why then we have gamma of 1.24 mega electron volts and lambda of one lambda of ELF, which would be, let's say, 20 hertz or 50 kilohertz, but 12.4 femto electron volts. Back to you.
The Planck equation relates wavelength and energy by the Planck constant. If I have a shorter wavelength or a higher frequency, each individual wave has a higher amount of energy. There's a direct relationship between frequency and energy, and that relationship is the Planck constant. When an electron has, by whatever means, been excited to a higher orbit, and it's not going to stay there, in most cases it's going to drop back to its normal orbit around that particular atom, there's an extremely specific amount of energy for each individual jump. So whether it if it jumps three steps and it goes down one of those steps, you get a certain amount of energy. If it goes down two of those steps, you get a lot more energy. If it jumps all three, you get a hell of a lot more energy. If it jumps down from step number two to step number one, you get a certain amount of energy. This has all been quantified. And the quantum nature of matter such that there's an exact amount of energy of each one of those jumps. When that energy jump occurs, the way Neil deGrasse Tyson explained it in one of his lectures that you can see on YouTube, let me drop, is that a photon comes out of that atom during the time that electron orbit jumped from a higher place down to a lower place. There's a photon that jumps out of there with an exact amount of energy and an exact wavelength. That photon comes out of there. One of the persons that was in a lecture that Neil deGrasse Tyson was given, which really sent him for a loop for a while, is that the person from the audience, who wasn't too much of a scientist, said, where did that photon come from? Was that photon always there ahead of time? And Neil said, no. The energy transfer of the electron going from a higher orbit down to a lower bar orbit means that it created that photon. And the person repeated the question, where did that photon come from? To which he said, it didn't come from a specific place. It got generated. To which he said, I just gave you a no to your question, did the photon always be there and got generated? I just gave you a no to that question. Where did that no come from? My brain generated that no that I just transmitted to you. So there's many processes in life where the exact mechanism by which the the resultant output is generated is not so clear.
Can you say a few words about quantum and quantizing based on Professor Levin?
No.
Oh, that's a good one.
What I mean is, no, I cannot. I've heard it so damn many times, I believe it, that all of these individual orbits are completely quantized. I don't have the vaguest idea why. So the answer to your question is, can I explain that? No. I don't know. Can you explain it? Back to you, Wes.
KC2, OLB with a quick comment.
KC2, OLB is what it sounded like. You said it so fast. Please give me your full call letters and your name, and then please give us your comment, because we're floundering on this one. Go right ahead, sir.
Kilo Charlie 2, Oscar Lima Bravo, and the name is Alan. And, yeah, believe it or not, you can kind of equate how quantum particles behave to how the planets orbit, but unfortunately there is, for quantum states such as an electron, there is and there has to be a discrete set value for the orbit. So you have to have, like, for example, n equals 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. But for some odd reason, you can have not values for orbits of planets. Even though they do, you know, the planets do obey the, you know, the law of gravitation, but which behaves very similarly to electrostatics, but the two, you know, set orbits don't coincide with each other.
The gentleman is right. The thing is that we try to knock the ping pong ball, and we think that we can coordinate a certain level at which the ping pong ball will bounce back. In quantum mechanics, it wouldn't do it. But in the real world, it doesn't matter. That means we have a fixed levels at which the electron can be, and it cannot be in the middle. The question arises that the planets could not really be at any particular orbit. It could be only in quantized orbit as well. But the difference between the quantums is so minimum. It's micrometers. It should not matter. And that's the Professor Leving statement. And to agree.
Now, let me go back to the beginning here, Alan. The original question was, yeah, I know that the real orbits of an electron around an atom, we draw diagrams as if it is a simple central force motion, like a planet going around the sun in a nice circular orbit or a slightly elliptical orbit. We know that the real orbits of electrons around atoms are much more complicated than that. Suborbitals and whatever, very complicated, slightly randomized patterns. However, the amount of energy from an excited state and the amount of energy of a less excited state is an extremely specific amount of quantized energy, as if we're working with integers only and no value in between is allowed. The original question is, why is no other value allowed? Why are there eigenvalues that are allowed? Only very specific values and nothing in between. KC2OLB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
From what I can remember, I'm pretty sure it has to do with the electron degeneracy states of either having a symmetrical or anti-symmetrical wave equation. But yeah, I'm actually trying the specifics right now because I'm driving around. But no, I will definitely get back to that because I do have the notes on it, and I believe that you will get a discontinuity if you were to solve the Schrödinger equation using a non-integer value of n, using a Taylor series expansion. But for, you know, planets, you know, it can have all values of n, odd or even values are perfectly acceptable. You can even have n equals 3 halves for you know, for a planet, but, you know, if you were to use that in quantum, you know, it absolutely won't work. I'm pretty sure because it has to do with the degenerate electron state.
Yeah, I think I can add to it that a photon is a single quantum of light, and is referred as a light quantum. So the energy of the electron bound to an atom is quantized, which results in the stability of atoms and of matter in general. But there is one very funny thing in it.
Hold on now. Let's let the machine drop. We've been overriding the timer. The Schrodinger wave equation that you mentioned, Alan, quite possibly was an equation that Schrodinger came up with to fit the measured performance. In other words, the experimental evidence showed certain characteristics, and in many of these cases, an equation is created that fits the observation. It's, in many cases, not the other way around. It's not the equation was created, and then all of a sudden we made a measurement. Sometimes it happens, but a hell of a lot of times, the equation was created to fit the observation. As such, to go back to the equation to try to find out why it's quantized might not be the right approach. There's probably a deeper mystery going on there. You see where I'm going with that one, Alan? KC2LLB, K2LIW.
Dick, you're completely right on that one. Each one has a very, very specific state, material, and application. KC2QIQ.
Okay, I'm going to have Alan answer it first, and then I'm going to ask you a further question on that one, Glenn. Alan, go right ahead.
KC2, Australia, Bravo. Yeah, no, absolutely. But what I was trying to say was that that each, I'm guessing that they follow each, you know, individual, you know, whole integer values of n only because of what we observed to see was that the properties of a fermion and boson provided us with anti-symmetrical and symmetrical wave equations. And, you know, through that, we have degenerate electron states. And, you know, I think, you know, that's probably the reason, you know, of course, you know, I'm doing, you know, using the equations to try to solve this, but, you know, I think it's because of the degenerate states that the electrons have within the atom that they have to be set values. They can't not be, because the wave, okay, look, yeah, the wave equations will have nodes and antinodes, and between those two, n equals 1 and n equals 2, you'll have a node. But I think it has to do with the degenerate property of the electrons.
Now, what I'm sensing from what you just said, Alan, is that the equation was set up that you're only allowed to plug in integers. And Schrodinger made these observations, set up an equation, and told you to only use integers in order to try to fit the real world. So he came up, I'm guessing, he and his buddies came up with an equation to fit the observation. It doesn't mean the equation really has all the information in there. As you get further measurements and you find exceptions to the equation, you start modifying it, and it's an evolving science where we develop a greater truth at a later time. We don't have all the information in the beginning, and you don't have 100% accuracy in those equations. You got to be careful how you use them is what I think is going on here. Maybe Glenn's got a different slant on this. KC2QIQ, K2LIW, go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, quantizing is something that's really a loosely used term. It means a lot of different things. It represents a lot of different equations. And what is the energy that you're trying to measure? What's happening here is that you have, you're dealing with, at a subatomic level, a piece of mass, and you're looking at how much energy relationship is related to that. It was very, very important back in the, you know, the 30s through the 50s to look at very heavy elements, look at things like uranium, that were generating energy. So when you're generating energy, basically you're looking at the material itself that was creating an electron movement in a direction that would create a wave of high frequency result. Then, but then again, there's, you know, there are other lighter elements, lighter than solids, that like gases and other things, where you can have electromagnetic radiation that affects it, and it moves an ionized system in the opposite direction. So you have to be very, very careful which kind of application you're putting these into and how to use them. So, I mean, there are some generalized equations of which they do work to and how you model them, but they are very specific for each application. KC2QIQ.
I vaguely remember when I first took my chemistry courses in college, they told us this was true, but didn't have a clear explanation for it. And for that matter, they told me how an antenna worked, but they really didn't have a clear explanation. I walked out of there not knowing how an antenna worked until a lot of years downrange as a ham radio operator. I figured out a number of things, a number of philosophies, a number of mental diagrams and diagrams I can put on paper that tell me something about how an antenna works. And that example I gave you guys before about the energy bouncing back and forth at least 20 times on the average antenna before it's radiated into space. No book, no respected textbook that I know of says those words. That may be the very basic bedrock of how an antenna must resonate first before it radiates and how it radiates. That may be the bedrock, might be.
Yeah, but if you take it from the fathers, Planck considered quanta to be a particle. What do you both say about that?
All kinds of people have said all kinds of things. That doesn't mean they're right. He may have built up a set of equations that worked for his particular set of experiments, assuming it's always a particle. Somebody else has got a set of equations and a bunch of experiments that prove that it's a wave. We have lots of evidence that it is both, depending on what you're doing and how you're doing it and how you make the measurements. So it's both particle and wave. You can't say it's all one or the other. The fact that some respected person said a pronouncement, he has to admit to himself if he's realistic. If he's a real scientist, if he's a real engineer, there is a certain error percentage in everything he does and everything he says. Nobody is 100% accurate all the time. You can dream about that if you want. You can insist on that in the way you approach all the people you deal with. And you're soon going to become very unpopular because they're going to pretty soon find holes in your philosophy and holes in your experiments and your statements and so on.
Oh, I agree with you perfectly. I would like to ask Glenn, because when Planck said about the particle, he also mentioned that he observed that in black by the radiation when it was heated and cold. She worries about it.
Wait for the machine to thoroughly drop. We're all overrunning the timer here.
Well, you know, here again, the black body experiments, the experiments with light wave duality, these are all practical experiments. In other words, these are all things where, you know, they're... I guess what happened was, you know, there's a period of time where physics moved from a very, very early state, you know, the Planck years, the Heisenberg years, and of course then where things were being quantized later in like the 1930s. And there's generally, even that's the way the physics courses move. You know, they start at one point and they move on. And then, you know, the descriptions of things change as things move on as well. But you have to realize, too, that even in all of this, Wesley, even like Dick is saying, that there are certain things that are just even conceptual in electrophysics. One thing like just the theory of a vacuum. A vacuum is a place in space where there's no matter at all, no electrons. So, I mean, the speed of light, C. C is the speed of light in vacuum. Well, if vacuum is already a concept of where there's a massless area, then what is the speed of light C? It is also a concept. You know, do these concepts really exist in the real world? They're, you know, but they're like starting points of all these equations. So a lot of this is also very, very conceptual science. KC2QIQ.
Yeah, and again, a few things. One humoristic. Dick is mostly made out of the vacuum, and it's the scientific statement. I wanted to, in the previous discussion of ours between me and Ben, I wanted to go to the steady magnetic field, and I remember when you pointed that The electromagnetic wave, which is the light, it has E and H. When you move, when you have H and you do the motion, then you create E whatsoever. Let me drop. Now, you said something that sounds for me very, very unclear. Maybe I would please, if you can, explain it to me. You were talking about steady magnets, magnetic field, and you, and I understood that when you create the movement in H, you have an E as well. Well, the major question was why the magnetic field of the magnet is not consumable. It has something to do with photon and energy.
I'm going to put some words on that and see if Glenn agrees with this. I've got a ball magnet in my hand, north at one end, south on the other end. Steady state ball magnet sitting on the table, not moving. By all kinds of techniques, like putting a piece of paper over top with iron filings and whatever, in theory, I can visualize the lines of magnetic field that, in my example, I'm going to say it flows out of the north end of the ball magnet and flows into the south end of the ball magnet. That steady state magnetic field sitting there with no change, in my opinion, generates no E field. However, if I take that magnet now and I plunge it into a coil, and there's a galvanometer, there's a Dawson valve movement, there's a meter movement or any other sensing device of current or voltage connected to that coil. When I plunge the magnetic field, when I plunge the bar magnet into the coil, I am moving the magnetic field, and that movement of magnetic field, the change in flux, the number of lines inside the coil changes, and voltage is generated by Faraday's law, Lenz's law, whatever you, however you want to explain it. So a change in magnetic field motion generates E, but there's a catch. Let me drop. But for an electromagnetic wave to exist, this E cross H, pointing vector, real electromagnetic wave propagating through some kind of a medium, sometimes vacuum, sometimes air, sometimes water, sometimes polyethylene, sometimes Teflon, whatever. That electromagnetic wave has an E and an H that during the propagation must be time coincident as well as orthogonal. In other words, if the wave is horizontally polarized, then the E is horizontal and the H must be vertical. And at the point in space, at that point in time where the E is maximum, the H must be maximum. A little bit further downrange in time, or a little bit further downrange in space, whichever you want to do, where the E goes through zero, the H goes through zero at the exact same point. One third of the world gets that backwards. Because I start off with a coil and a capacitor on the table, and I study it as I put a signal through it at resonance, the energy bounces back and forth between the coil and the capacitor. At the time that the coil is giving maximum magnetic field, the voltage is zero, or at the time the voltage is going through zero, they were 90 degrees out of phase in the LC network, and people assume that electromagnetic wave does that also. The radiated electromagnetic wave, they're at right angles spatially, but they are time coincident temporally. And a number of textbooks have that backwards. You go to the right...
Dick, can I just mention something here?
Go ahead, Glenn.
I just want to let the commercial run through. You have to be careful with that one. And the reason why is because you're dealing with four units. E, I, B, and H. So in other words, you have the volt, ampere, and you have the flux and path length. So H is path length, B is flux intensity, E is, you know, voltage charge, and I is current. Now the thing is that if you're looking at, depending on the chart or the graph that you're looking at, you can have a BH graph, right? You can have a an EH graph, but then you could have an E, B graph. So in other words, depending on, and you have to look very, very carefully at the units that you're looking at, because they will be 90 degree differences in each one. KC2QIQ.
I think you're talking about the graphs that talk about mu, permeability, saturation, and whatever, of magnetic material. And yes, the magnetic material.
That's BH, excuse me.
Yeah, when you're talking about what happens within magnetic materials, I'm going to agree with you. If I'm talking about an electromagnetic wave in free space.
B and H are at 90 degrees from each other. So if B is flux intensity, H is path length, and they are 90 degrees apart.
Be careful now. Stand by. Let me get a beep. If I take an electromagnetic wave that's propagating to the north, parallel to the Earth, I've generated this horizontally polarized electromagnetic wave. I've aimed my Yagi antenna to the north. I've radiated this wave. And a mile out in front of my antenna, when everything is stabilized, I now have the ability, in my mind, to stop time, to stop motion, and analyze that wave. Here's what I'm about to say, and I'm about to ask you if you agree or disagree, Glenn. I'm saying that for that horizontally polarized wave, the E field, no matter what units I use, are horizontal and parallel to the Earth. The H field, the magnetic field, no matter what units I use, is perpendicular to the Earth. And that at the place in space, in the Z-axis toward north, I've aimed the signal toward the north, at the place in space where I've stopped time, I've stopped motion, and I've analyzed it, at the place in space where the E is maximum, I say the H is maximum. Do you disagree with any of those statements? Over to you, Glenn, K2LIW.
No, not at all. But here's the problem. The problem is, depends on how it's being described and how it's being graphed. I and H, now I and B are at 90 degrees, right? In which you use right-hand rule. You take your right hand, hold your thumb up. What happens is the current, which is I, is at 90 degrees from B. And then, let's see, E is at 90 degrees from H. But now, depending on if someone were to give you a graph that were, what is it, B versus H. I got to write it down on a piece of paper, Dick. I'm confusing myself right now. KC2QIQ.
Yeah, hold on, though. There's a huge ambiguity happening in those words, Glenn. When you say at right angles and 90 degrees, you haven't clearly defined whether or not you're speaking temporally or spatially. When you say the word 90 degrees, do you mean something is 90 degrees ahead or behind in the time domain, in phase, or when you say things are 90 degrees
spatially?
You didn't say the word spatial, so therefore half the people listening to that might be confused. So each...
I'm confused, Dick, and I'm the one saying it.
I got news for you. The blind is leading the blind here. I set up this experiment where I set up some equipment with my own hands, with the help of my buddies. I set up this antenna, and I listened to that signal coming from the moon. And I know that not one single electron left that antenna on the moon. There's nothing but hard vacuum in space between moon and Earth. Some amount of energy at 2287.5 megahertz flowed out of that antenna on the moon, flowed into my antenna in Farmingdale, flowed into my feed horn that I built with my own hands, through the parametric amplifier that I borrowed from Airborne Instruments Laboratories, Advanced Electronics Department, flowed through the rest of my receiver system, and eventually came out of the loudspeaker. What the hell really flowed through space? Energy, photons, it flowed through the phlogiston, electromagnetic waves. I know that free space had no energy before they turned on the transmitter. No particles of any kind that I can recognize were there during the time the transmitter was running. When they turned off the transmitter, again, there was nothing there. Yet something got to me. True energy in a measurable number of microvolts and picowatts, some true amount of energy arrived at my antenna by way of my... By way of my engineering experience, I can predict quantitatively what's going to happen. I know how many watts they transmitted. I know how many dB of gain was the antenna. I know how much so-called free space loss there is over across the 240,000 miles between Moon and Earth. I knew the area and effective capture area and efficiency of my 12-foot diameter dish. I knew something about the aperture distribution of that feed horn. So therefore, I could predict within a small number of decibels exactly how much signal I was going to pick up and whether or not it was going to be above the threshold of the noise figure of the receiver at that bandwidth that I was using. I got all the numbers essentially right. I still don't know what the hell really happened. KC2QIQ, K2RIW. Go ahead, Glenn.
Thanks for the delay, Dick, because it gave me a chance here to write this on a piece of paper, and now I can explain it. What I'm doing is I took a piece of paper in front of me and I'm drawing this out just so I have a visual in front of me as I'm trying to explain this. If I have a piece of wire and I were to put, you know, plus on one end, minus on the other end, and I create a direction of current flow, and I were to draw my finger, put my thumb in the direction of the current flow through the wire on my right hand and then wrap my fingers around it, what I'm doing is I'm putting an I into the wire, or a current, and I'm getting a B field, okay, that is basically at 90 degrees spatially around that wire. Now, if I were to look at the E, or the voltage that's on the other side, it would be spatially 90 degrees from B. So if I were to say that basically I were to have a EH field in a resistive, like, in other words, a resistive component of air, in other words, the RO of air is like 377. In that particular condition, my E field and my H field would have a 90 degree separation spatially. I think that answers your question correctly, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Maybe yes, maybe no. You described a steady state situation of a steady state voltage applied to a wire of a finite resistance, a measurable amount of current flowed. By way of the right-hand rule of your thumb and the things wrapping around the wire, I know the magnitude of a steady state B field, magnetic field, that was created around that wire. But that will not radiate into space in any reasonable distance. I can't communicate with that at a mile away, so to speak. I now have to make a amplitude module. I have to make a sinusoidal current flowing through that wire, which is going to make a sinusoidal modulated magnetic field around that wire. And if I do that just right, and I call it an antenna, I now radiate a EMT, electromagnetic wave, into free space. And the majority of the questions I think Wes is asking, and many people are asking, including me, is that wave that's radiated into space that obeys the pointing vector rule of E cross H and what's the direction of propagation and the magnitude of the signal and so on, that's what I think we're really getting down to. We have to have a sinusoidal current flowing through that wire before we can call it a real electromagnetic antenna. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
The idea still should work, though. Because, in other words, if we're saying that if our antenna was effectively resistive to 377 ohms, which is the RO of natural space, so in other words, and we were to apply a voltage, matched voltage, in a sine wave, it's the carrier frequency of an RF wave, across our length of wire, which is 90 degrees in either direction. And the current that's building up in that wire is in resistance, so our voltage and current components are building in the same vector. So the voltage and the current are in phase in the resistor. The B field will be spatially 90 degrees from that. Now I also have the path length of the antenna. It starts from the plus end of the tip of one of the antennas, and the H field is closed around the return end of the other end of the 90 degrees half of, or the counterpoise size of the side of the dipole. So that's the total path length is around the outside of the two radiators. Now, if I were to draw that current through that path, returning back to the other side, it's a closed loop. So now I can say, yes, I know the direction of H. I know that the B field is generated in one direction, and then it just reverses the cycle and comes back the other way. So it is in phase. So E and H are always at 90 degrees into a resistive circuit like that, Dick. So it does work. KC2QIQ.
At the end, you again said the E and the H are 90 degrees. You didn't make it clear spatially or temporally.
Spatially.
Okay. As I put that sinusoidal current into that piece of wire, and I generate that magnetic field by the right-hand rule, does the magnetic field, well, first of all, the sinusoidal current flowing through the wire, first goes positive, goes through zero, goes negative, goes back through zero, and the E field is also, the H field is generated from that current flow. Is the H field temporally coincident with the E field? At the instant the E field hits maximum, does the H field hit maximum at the same instant of time? Over to you, Glenn, K2LIW.
Okay, if you have a piece of paper in front of you, try to draw this. Now, let's draw a dipole where you have a quarter wavelength on one side, a quarter wavelength on the other side. You've got your feed line in the center, and you're tuning your center to, let's say, your 72 ohm point in the middle. And on the one side, label one side plus, in other words, all the way at the end of one dipole, one quarter wavelength at the very end, name one side plus, go down all the way to the other side of your counterpoise side or the and label that one minus, and create a starting point. Start your current flow in the first driving end of your radiator to the left, which I'm going to call plus, and what I would also do is draw a dotted line around the outside from plus to minus, which is going to represent the closing of the H field, and it will return through the negative side, so that basically on your piece of paper, both arrows are in the same direction. In other words, you have a current direction from the minus going back towards the coaxial feed line, and on the plus side you have an arrow coming out of the feed line towards the plus side. So the arrows of current direction are always in the same direction. So the H field, if you draw the dotted lines from the plus end of the one end of the dipole, return it to the other end, you're closing the loop. So now you have a drawn in H field. Do you have that? Are you following that so far, Dick?
Yeah, but I'm worried that those H fields, the way you're drawing it, don't sound or appear to be at every square millimeter of space. They do not appear, in your description, to be orthogonal. H and E at every millimeter of space of the radiated wave has to be temporally coincident and spatially orthogonal. Are all of those H lines orthogonal to all of those E lines? Back to you, Glenn.
Well, there's going to be, it depends on the flux density. In other words, that's B. So in other words, if you take the radiating length of your dipole and you put your thumb towards the plus end, or depending on how you're defining your current flow, put your thumb in that direction, wrap your fingers around the outside, and that's your flux intensity. So in other words, how dispersed those H lines are going to be coming around the outside spatially are going to be dependent on the flux intensity. So let's start off with something relatively small signal, so that we can basically just draw single lines of H, you know, completing that field. Do you follow me there?
I do, but I've got a problem. When it comes to a half wavelength antenna, yeah, if I'm building a rhombic or a Beveridge antenna, which is a zillion wavelengths long, I now can have a traveling wave that goes down the wire once, hits a terminating resistor at the end, and dies. That's not our antenna. You're in my finite length, half wavelength, standing wave structure must have at each instant of time a wave that's flowing from the transmission line in the center out toward the tips, and is almost a identical amplitude of waveform of the standing wave flowing from the outer tips toward the center. There's a wave of energy flowing in both directions. That's what a standing wave is. The antenna only radiates well with the time. In other words, the transient phenomena of the antenna are really yucky. The steady state performance of the antenna, there's got to be a standing wave. The standing wave, by definition, means that there's almost an identical magnitude of waveform at each instant of time flowing outward, and there's identical magnitude of waveform at each instant of time flowing inward on that same wire structure. That's what really gets radiated. Life gets complicated when you include that detail. It doesn't radiate well without resonance. Resonance and standing wave come together, and there's got to be equal energy flowing in both directions simultaneously. You see the complication going on here, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Yeah, I do, but I, it may not be as complicated as you think. I think what's really happening here is that you, as the current is flowing down that wire, you are generating a magnetic field, and it's synchronous to the that magnetic field is synchronous to the current flowing down the wire. So you're going to generate that B field. It's going to close an H field around the outside of the antenna. Now, each time that signal in resonance is changing direction and going back and forth, it has to break that H field down and build it up again in the other direction so that the energy to build and collapse that field each time takes power, and that's the RO, or the effective radiated resistance of space. So I don't think we're violating any rules here. KC2QIQ.
Yeah, I haven't said that we're violating any rules. I'm trying to figure out what the real rules are to create radiation. And yep, current's got to flow. Standing wave's got to be set up most of the time, 90-some-odd percent of the time. E and H have to be generated. In the reactive near field of the antenna, remember I said everything's got to be orthogonal. Inside the reactive near field, where the wave front comes out quasi-spherical, and you get local capacitive coupling effects, magnetic coupling effects, making measurements and understanding them inside of the near field of the antenna is an art and science into itself. And to try to predict how Mother Nature is going to straighten that all out, and so out in the far field, how it's going to become a nice, eventual, well-behaved, planar wave in between the point of generation on the antenna and that point that I just described out in space where it all straightens itself out, in between to a naive person, all hell breaks loose. To a person who's studied it enough, they think they understand the individual steps and can predict that when I make, let me drop. The really smart electromagnetic theory people can take these highly contaminated near-field measurements of E and H with something like a Satomo machine and figure out how Mother Nature is going to straighten that all out and what the final radiated wave is going to look like. But that's far from a simple problem. So what's really going on at the microscopic level or the macroscopic level, but near the wire, is far from simple is what I'm afraid of, Glenn. But still, a lot of apparent orthogonality, I believe, takes place, spatial orthogonality, and a lot of temporal coincidences are taking place in order to really generate that that pointing vector that really gives you the energy transfer of this final electromagnetic wave. And that wave is finally radiated. Is it particle or is it wave? And the answer is yes. Over to you to add some words to this one, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
VDH, we're coming.
VDH, recognized right after Glenn. Glenn first, go ahead.
I think in this particular case, especially at the lower frequencies, most of this can really be explained with current and magnetic field in this particular area. And I can see how that, you know, like what you're saying is that if the RO of free space is like 377, and you're talking about a dipole of like 72 ohms, and each side is one quarter of that, and there's going to have to be some reinforcement. And so in other words, it's going to take many cycles before this thing is going to basically turn into a nice pattern coming off at the end of this. And of course you have the near field problem, that because the H field at a large enough flux intensity, there's going to be an overlap of flux intensity fields. In other words, if you look at the distance of these flux lines due to the B field, they're going to be extending out and then crossing over the H field lines, which is the path line coming back to the other side of the antenna. So in other words, it's going to take quite a few cycles before all this is going to straighten out in free space so that everything's nicely in line with the RO of 377 square in space. So yeah, it's going to take some distance and before all of those lines of flux are in a nice pattern shape. I'm going to pass it back to you, Dick. K2RW, KC2QIQ, and pick up the breaking station.
Yeah, and what you and I have been discussing up till now is steady state performance of the antenna. When it's been running for, let me pick a number, 50 microseconds or longer, you really study the transient effect of these standing wave structures, and wow, life gets a little bit more complicated. Give me the full call that is there, VDH, and your name, sir. And please try to educate us on this one. We're floundering. VDH, K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Okay, fine business, Dick. Yeah, the call is WA2BDH. Name is John. I had a couple of questions, something I'm not too sure of. First of all, on the idea of the spatial right angleness of this, that is the E and H field being at right angles, I think that could be shown by the curl of E, from Maxwell's equations, curl of E equals minus the partial V respected T. Because that's going to give you something where if the E field is, say, E sub X, then the H field would have to be like H.